Level 3 body armor. Brett glanced to his rear and saw they were alone. He snapped forward, looping his arm around the man's neck and kicking the back of his knee. The man struggled for a second, then Brett lured him to the ground unconscious. He whispered, "You should watch them, dumbass." Shoshana stuck with the tour group as they approached the shrine of the Bab, its golden dome towering above the terrain of the gardens. The tourists began to spread out, viewing the expansive garden next to the temple and entering the shrine itself. She found herself alone and circled quickly to the right of the temple, searching for the entrance and a place to hide until the tour continued its march. She went down a flight of stone steps and found herself in a cul-de-sac of sculptured shrubs, looking like a set from a Dr. Seuss movie, the bushes turning the area into a makeshift maze not unlike a Christmas tree lot. About 40 feet in diameter, it was ringed by a 9-foot wall of stone. A good place to hide until the tour moved on, but not what she wanted, as there was no escape route other than the stairs. She turned to leave, and the stone in front of her smacked her face with spall. She immediately flung herself backward, rolling over her back onto her feet. Someone had fired at her, and now she was trapped. She had to get out immediately. Pike would be attacking soon, and he would be coming in hard. He knew what she was capable of, and would want to overwhelm her. She ran toward the wall and leapt up, missing the top and falling back down. She heard footsteps pounding down the stairs and ducked behind one of the shrubs, peering through the foliage. One man reached the bottom, a pistol held to the front. She didn't recognize him from Pike's team. She breathed through an open mouth, her own pistol at the ready, waiting for him to conduct a systematic search, hoping to slip into a place he'd cleared and get back up the stairs while he continued. She watched him and learned that wasn't going to happen. His technique wasn't methodical, with him slowly walking through the area behind the barrel of his weapon. Instead, he began moving in a rapid, practiced manner, attempting to flush her out while providing a shifting target to hit. He was skilled. She crouched and began backpedaling, stopping when her back was to the wall. She turned and looked up, considering another attempt, but knowing she'd be highlighted for him to take a shot at her. The searcher came one row over, racing down it, his weapon sweeping left and right. She took aim and fired a double tap, and missed. The man oriented on the sound of her suppressor, without any physical fear of her shots, coming straight through the shrubs with his gun and a high two-handed grip. As soon as he cleared them, she fired, hitting him in the chest. Her weapon locked open on an empty magazine, and the round rocked him back, staggering him. Then he kept coming. Body armor. Shit. He brought his weapon to bear, and she screamed, throwing the pistol at his head and launching herself at him. He instinctively ducked the projectile and returned to aim, but she was on him like a cyclone. She grabbed his wrists with both hands, controlling the pistol, and planted her right leg behind his knee. Teeth bared, she surged forward with her entire weight, flipping him over her leg and slamming him to the earth. On the way down, he fired 1, 2, 3 times, the bullets snapping by her brow. He hit the ground hard, and she landed on his stomach with her knees, punching the body armor and knocking the wind out of him with a visible grunt. She torqued his weapon to the ground, slamming it into a rock and breaking his hold, the pistol bouncing away. He sprang up on his knees, swinging at her head with a wild blow. She blocked it and rotated to his back, locking her legs around his waist. She grabbed the top of the plate carrier through his shirt and yanked down, hearing the Velcro holding it in place tear slightly, enough to send the ceramic front plate into his throat and causing him to gargle. He staggered upright, rising like a zombie with her on his back, wildly swinging his arms to get her off. She tucked her head and dug in, cinching her legs and using the weight of her body as leverage on the armor. His breathing began to rasp, and she let up lightly, then slammed down again, feeling the Velcro rip free under his arms and giving her the leverage she needed. He fell to his knees, no longer attempting to attack her, but now trying to fight the armor. She leapt off him, lined up, and threw a spinning kick with all the force in her hip, whipping her foot around hard enough to crunch his cheek. He felt like he'd been hit with a cinder block. She grabbed his pistol and sprinted back up the stairs, the barrel leading the way. She reached the top and saw no threat. She stuffed the pistol behind her back and began running down the stairs toward the traffic circle below, no longer caring about the cover of the tourists. She crossed the garden bridge over Abbas Street and kept going, ignoring the views and focusing on the finish. She finally reached the traffic circle and found the iron gate to it closed. She began climbing, with the tourists on the other side taking pictures up the slope, amazed at her actions. She flung herself over and began running down the street, thinking of escape, thinking of where she could go. She saw a bus stop ahead of her and recognized the line to Acre. Better than nothing, a clean break. She ran on board and paid the fare, then sank down into her seat, breathing heavily and thinking about her predicament. The bus began to pull away, with her mind working furiously over her next steps. Because of it, she missed the Orthodox Jew who entered behind her, and the fact that he was talking on a cell phone.
21. I reached the traffic circle at the base of the gardens and pulled up short, letting the tour buses go around and around for their pictures. I clicked into the radio. Blood, we're finally at the bottom. What's the status? I got one bad guy down, but Shoshana did her own damage. I got cops all over the place. What happened? I'm up for ideas. I took the guy that went long. He was setting up for an ambush, so I took him out. She did something. I don't know what, but whatever it was complete. They've got an ambulance here, and it's not for my guy. All I did was choke him out. No permanent damage. Where is she? I tracked her to the traffic circle at the base of the gardens, and she boarded a bus going to Acre. I couldn't follow, obviously. You were right. She's on the warpath. I said, okay, okay. So, she's good? She's free? Yeah, she's free from here. But I don't know what assets are against her. If you're asking if I was successful in protecting her, I'll tell you that I was here. Here. I don't know about anything else. Shit. Brett had worked operations like this for a decade. He was putting a little frosting on the turd with that answer. He had gotten her clear from the gardens, but he didn't think that was the end. I gave him our location and waited on him to arrive. Why won't she fucking answer her damn phone? Jennifer said, what now? I don't know. She's in the wind, and she's being chased by a team. Apple Watch is still out there, and he was just security in a car. We know they had a team that went up, and there's no way Shoshana eliminated them all. If she had, she would have walked out the front door instead of jumping in front of us. Jennifer said, why do you think she looked at us that way? She wanted to shoot us. I don't know. I thought about that. I don't know. Jennifer toyed with a napkin between our seats, then said, I think I do. She thinks you're after her. What? That's fucking crazy. All I did was ask for dinner. Don't get mad. But she is a little off. I think she saw you and made a connection to something that isn't there. What about all that empath shit? Where she can see a threat? The thing you think is real? Why would she look at me as a threat? Jennifer exhaled and said, good question, I don't know. I said, I do, because she's fucking crazy. Jesus, I should have never called. Jennifer looked at me with a side eye and said, really? Your call caused this?
So you completely ignored all task force protocols to go running up here to protect her, ignoring our main target? Quit it.
I sighed and said, okay, I'm worried about her. That look wasn't right. She wanted to shoot me for real. I saw it. She bolted, not because she was deciding whether she should or not. Just that she didn't have the time to waste.
I know. And it's also irrelevant. This is like trying to save a tiger in the water. We want to help, but the tiger thinks we mean harm. In the end, you have to rescue the tiger no matter how much it claws.
Brett came up, slapping the window. I popped the locks and he slid into the back. He said, okay, she did some serious damage. The guy she took out looks like he's been through a meat grinder. He's on the way to the hospital alive, but I'm surprised she didn't kill him. And your guy? He's probably slinking back to the base right now, coming up with a story of how he was blindsided by Batman. I put the car into drive and pulled away. Jennifer said,
what now?
I guess head on back to Tel Aviv and try to at least accomplish our mission. It's going to be hard enough explaining this detour to Kurt. We gave her a day, maybe more. Jennifer sat up straight in her seat and said,
are you kidding me? We did this today, but didn't solve the problem.
The words were music to my ears. I said, so you want to continue flagrantly ignoring our mission, which, by the way, is paying our salary, to go chase that nutcase? Brett's head went back and forth between us, but I knew he didn't care. He just liked watching the fight, even though he didn't realize there wasn't one. Jennifer became incensed, saying,
okay, I made a joke about the gardens today, but there's no way I'm leaving Shoshana out on her own with a team of assassins hunting her. A team, I might add, that's tied to our mission. What the hell has come over you? You're always the first to tip over the apple cart.
Brett started laughing, now in on the joke. She turned to him and snapped,
you think this is funny? You think her getting killed is humor?
He said, I think Pike was looking for a solution, not a fight. She looked at me, and I grinned. She smacked my shoulder and said,
why do you do that stuff? Just agree with me. I'm always right.
I passed through a traffic light and said, yeah, that's true. But we still have no leverage, no anchor to tug on. She sat in the car, tapping her fingers on the dash. And I knew her mind was working 1,000 miles a second. I honestly had no idea what to do next, and I'd done the 1,000 miles a second routine. I was willing to see what her brain could come up with. She finally said,
okay, we know she's being hunted, right?
Yep.
And we know that they're good at what they do. They've managed to plan an operation against her using both native assets and transnational killers. They have some talent. And they have some money behind them. They won't stop because of what happened today, and we probably didn't short out their ability to succeed.
I said, okay, that's reassuring. So we have no idea how to find Shoshana, but they do, and they're going to kill her. Great.
That's not true. We know at least 3 of the players that are hunting her, right?
Who?
Apple Watch, the Orthodox Jew, and the man he met at the Marina restaurant.
Yeah, I guess that's right. You mean we have their cell phone numbers?
Yes, exactly. And we know Shoshana is going to Acre. And that's only 30 minutes away.
Wait. We know she got on a bus that goes to Acre. We have no idea if she's riding it the whole way. Jennifer pursed her lips, not liking the logic, and said,
okay. We know she's on the bus, and we know the location it ends at.
So?
So, if these fucks are so good at their job, they'll find her. All we need to do is find them.
I sat in silence for a moment, just letting the car glide forward. It was pure genius. I glanced into the rearview mirror, catching Brett's eye. He said, you screwed up bringing her on board. You're no longer the smartest person in the room. Jennifer perked up at the comment, looking like Marissa Tomei at the courtroom scene of My Cousin Vinny. If she'd put her hands on the dash and shrugged, it would have been a fait accompli. I said, dial up Creed. Get us a geolocation of those numbers.
22. Shoshana waited until the bus reached the apex of its route, stopping outside the old citadel of Acre. A crusader castle that was jam-packed with tourists, it bled into the Turkish bazaar, a maze that would allow her to disappear. She knew of a youth hostel deep in its embrace that would be completely outside of the scope of anyone searching for her, even Pike. She exited after everyone else, glancing left and right, not realizing she'd already had a bullseye placed on her head. She hit the street and glided through the tourists, moving swiftly into the citadel and ignoring the pleas of those outside begging for money. She raced through the exhibit, searching for the exit on the far side, the one that would let her into the Turkish bazaar. She was growing more and more paranoid. Pike had an ability like hers, she was sure. He could see where she went, could feel her weakness. He was coming, and she was dead. Given all her missions in the Mossad, she came as close as she ever had to total panic. And it was precisely because she'd found a reason to live. Before, if she'd have died, it was just something that happened, and might actually release her from the trials the Mossad had put her through. Now, she had a reason to live. And if that meant killing Pike Logan, she'd do it. But she didn't think she could. He would win. She'd seen it. She exited the walls of the Crusader Museum and followed the signs for the bazaar, an ancient Turkish market buried in the narrow stone alleys outside the castle. It was once the primary market for the locals, and still was to a certain extent, but it now catered to tourists as well, selling more souvenirs than spice. She went down an alley, looking for the hostel she remembered, something backpackers used, with no outward signs of availability. A place that was found through word of mouth in internet chat rooms, Vice, and the advertising. She broke through the alley and found herself in the market, stalls left and right selling everything from candy to leather goods. She continued forward, her head swiveling, sliding through the mass of humanity, looking for a threat. She went deeper, and the street signs went from Hebrew to Arabic. She believed she was in far enough to be secure. No way would anyone but an Israeli be able to find her here. She began to relax, blending in with the throngs of tourists out to see a real market, even as the shop owners catered to their whim of what real meant, doing whatever it took to get a sale. She felt her stomach growl and realized she hadn't eaten since she'd awoken. She'd been going on adrenaline and fear for hours. She saw a shawarma stall and went to it. She bought a meal of lamb and slid in behind the stove to eat it on a chipped picnic table. She devoured the food, feeling more comfortable about where she stood. She considered contacting Aaron. She hadn't before because of the mission, waiting on him to call her. But this had obviously changed things. Her phone was still in the hotel, and she'd have to think a bit about how to get back there. She was sure she could. Pike might have surveillance on it, but odds were he knew she wouldn't return. He wouldn't waste time on that. She took a bite, gazing across the concourse, and froze. She saw Jennifer coming through an alley, the light from the outside silhouetting her in the gloom of the market. At first, she thought she was wrong, because it couldn't be, but it was. And behind her was Pike. Her world collapsed. It was unreal. There was no way they could have found her, and yet here he was. She lowered herself, putting the food on her plate and withdrawing her pistol. She mentally prepared to kill those she loved. A necessary evil. She saw Jennifer looking at a device in her hands, trying to orient it, which was confusing. They were tracking her through electronic means? No way. She'd left her phone in the hotel. She had nothing on her that could be tracked. Nothing. It took a moment for the truth to settle. They're tracking someone else. They came across the food court trying to look like a couple on a date. But she saw the adrenaline in Pike's face. He was on the hunt. But for whom? She slid backward, keeping low, leaving her food behind. She turned, about to sprint out of the area, when she heard a commotion behind her. She whipped around and saw that Pike had an Orthodox Jew on the fetid stone floor, torquing his arm in a manner it wasn't meant to go, jamming the man's face into the offal from a millennium of travelers. She slid forward, hiding behind the table. She heard, "Where is Shoshana? How many men are in here looking for her?" The man said, "No one, I swear, I just called them. They're on the way, but they aren't here." Pike slid down to his level, gave him the full heat of his gaze, and hissed, "If she's hurt, you're going to feel pain you have never imagined." The words sank in, and it was a revelation, a mishmash of emotions that she'd never expected to feel. It righted everything she'd known for the last 4 days. All the fear and trepidation she'd felt fell away like the chrysalis of a butterfly. Pike was pure, and her instincts had been right. She saw Pike crank the man's arm back and heard the wail. She stood up, providing a view of her body. Jennifer saw her and slapped a hand on Pike's shoulder. Shoshana said, "I'm over here. Right here." Pike released the guy on the ground and stood up. He said, "You want to take his place? Because I'm about to do the same to you. At least he has a phone that he actually answers." She gave a brilliant smile, showing her teeth, the relief flooding through her. She said, "You're just sweet on me." 23. Aaron heard the men stir on the far side of the cell and knew the time was coming close. When they'd arrived last night, after 12 hours of riding under the carpet in the back of the SUV, their captors had separated Alex from Aaron and tossed him into a room with little light, the only illumination coming from a cracked window high on the wall. He was surrounded by prisoners who flitted about like roaches, all seeking to escape attention from the guards. He was the only Caucasian in the place. He hoped the fact that they had separated Alex meant they at least understood what would happen to her if she were to be incarcerated with him. The prison was a decrepit cinder block structure, without even bars or individual cells. All the men were thrown together, which made rest difficult. At least getting locked up alone would have meant enough security to sleep. He'd learned early that these prisoners were different from what would be expected. They weren't here for petty street crimes. They were imprisoned for something else. Some wore the tattered remnants of military and police uniforms. Others clung to the remains of business suits. And they were tribal. The uniform crowd kept to themselves, and they seemed to want to curry favor with the guards by abusing other inmates, as if their actions had an impact on how long they would remain. The ones in civilian clothes were different, special. As a class, they weren't overtly abused, and the uniformed prisoners seemed to defer to them. From what Aaron could see, their punishment came at the hands of the guards, with restricted movement in the prison and less food. Aaron belonged to a third class, the one of victim. A minority of the prisoners belonged to neither tribe, and they were the ones whom the uniformed prisoners preyed upon, to the delight of the actual guards. Tonight, it was Aaron's turn. Aaron had taken the farthest pallet from the door, putting his back to the wall, and stretching out his shackled legs, waiting for nightfall, waiting on the darkness. Now he listened to the rustling and feigned sleep. There was enough light in the gloom to make out shapes, and he could see the guard outside the cell room, faintly illuminated by a single bulb. That would be the trigger. He mentally began rehearsing how many he could remove before he went down. Breathing long and slow, he prepared for the fight. He saw the guard get off his stool and wander down the hall. He felt the adrenaline surge. Showtime. No sooner had the guard disappeared than seven men stood up, walking slowly toward him, attempting to maintain silence. The leader was in the front, and that's whom Aaron would take first. He waited until the first row of four was standing above him, then reached out and snatched the ankles of the leader. With a roar, he powered up, ripping the man off his feet and slamming his head into the concrete floor. The other man actually leapt back at his yell and the violence, momentarily confused. Aaron used the stitch, the small bit of precious time. Keeping the corner to his back, he shuffled forward, his arms cracking out with the speed of a whip, his fists connecting with the first three men, a startlingly rapid attack. They did whatever it took to get out of range, scrambling back and exposing the second row of three. The surprise gone, these were ready, circling to the left and right and bouncing on their feet, their shackled chains ringing on the concrete. They came in at the same time. Aaron tucked, placing his elbows against his head to absorb the blows, knowing the prisoner chains on their ankles would prevent knees and kicks. He was hammered above his ears repeatedly, the punches doing little damage. He waited for an opening, then shot an uppercut almost from the ground, lifting one of the men off his feet, teeth twinkling in the twilight as they spewed out of his shattered face. Aaron turned to the other two, only to find himself now facing all five. They closed in for the kill. Aaron raised his fists. The men circled, laughing at his predicament, sure in their numbers, not realizing what they faced. Aaron was a grinder, a pounder. He'd spent close to 20 years learning how to destroy men with his hands alone, and after all that time, he'd learned to play to his strengths. He was no Jackie Chan, doing fancy kung fu maneuvers. His power lay in his fists, in a stand-up slugfest. While the shackles were stifling the men's ability to use kicks, they did nothing to Aaron's fighting effort. He could take a punch, take a great many punches, and he could return them with a force few could withstand. He kept the corner to his back and waded in, swinging his fists in jackhammer blows. His punches glanced off two of them, then connected solidly with one, dropping him like a puppet with the strings cut. He continued, tucked in and low, bobbing and weaving, blocking fists and snapping heads. In frustration, one of the men did what Aaron feared most. He screamed and jumped inside Aaron's range, wrapping his arms around Aaron's waist. Before Aaron could get free, the remaining men jumped on him, causing them all to crash to the ground in a heap. Aaron brought his legs up and circled the chains from his shackles around a neck, launching his legs back out and jerking the man off him. He tucked his head as the remaining three began to beat him, knowing his time was running out. He wrapped one arm around his skull and snapped out with the other one, popping a man hard enough to split his lips. He whipped his feet out, spreading his legs wide, hearing the man in chains gargle. He grabbed the throat of the man above him, holding him in a death grip. He leaned back until the man's head was against the wall, then punched him in the forehead, causing his skull to ricochet. He focused on the final man, grabbing a thatch of hair like he was pulling weeds, and drawing his arm back like a piston. Before he could swing, a dozen flashlights split the darkness, and shouted orders filled the air. The guards poured in ostensibly to save him from getting beaten to death. They ran in with a choreographed charade, batons out, only to halt, the yelling fading away. He found himself facing Lurch, looking confused and astonished at the carnage. Lurch began screaming in Sesotho, and Aaron tossed the remaining conscious prisoner away, then untangled himself from the man still in his chains. One of the guards checked the prisoner Aaron had choked, then rattled off something, causing two guards to flee the room. Lurch's face split into a smile. He squatted down until he was level with Aaron. "Bad, bad mistake, Jew. I don't know why you were in here to begin with." He turned and used his baton to poke the body of the man Aaron had choked with his chains. "But now it's murder, and there is a specific punishment for that." He raised his baton, and a voice from the back of the room floated out. "Leave him be." A tall prisoner, gaunt, wearing the remnants of slacks and a suit jacket, came forward. His coffee-colored skin was stretched taut, with pronounced cheekbones, and so little body fat one could trace the pulse in the veins of his neck. But he held himself as if he weren't in prison. Lurch said, "This doesn't concern you." "I decide what concerns me. Leave him be." Lurch began rapidly shouting in the Sesotho language, but the man remained unmoved. Lurch pointed his baton at the man, glared at Aaron, then flicked his head at the guards. They left the room, with Lurch giving one last stare, a beam of pure hatred. The man held out his hand, helping Aaron to his feet. He said, "My name is Thomas Naboni. You are not the usual type we get in here." He laughed at his joke. Unsure of what had just happened, Aaron said, "Thank you." Thomas smiled, his teeth gleaming white and in perfect condition, a stark contrast to the rest of his appearance. He said, "When a man helps another out of free will, it says something of his character." Still confused, Aaron thought he was referring to himself. "Yes, and I appreciate it." Thomas said, "I'm talking about you. As hungry as you must be, you gave your food to another." The guards had brought their meager rations earlier in the day, and one of the suit prisoners had been refused food, a stick of a man who was clearly starving. The others of that clan had shared their portions, and Aaron had kicked in, solely because the man looked on the verge of death. "A half cup of soiled rice saved my life." Remembering the deference the guards had paid him, Aaron said, "I only did what I thought was right. Who are you?" Thomas waved the question off and said, "Doing what is right is why you are alive now. The better question is why you are in here at all. What is your crime?" Aaron said, "I'm a mistake. I've done nothing." Thomas laughed and said, "Like us all. Like us all." 24. Like everyone else on the aircraft, Johann von Rensburg stared intently out the window, waiting on the land to reveal itself below the weather they were in. The aircraft circled, one wing held low, lining up with the small national airfield of Lesotho, Africa. Unlike the rest of the passengers, either tourists anxious to see the exotic land for the first time, or natives to whom air travel was a luxury rarely experienced, Johann was looking for something specific. The aircraft broke through the low-hanging clouds, and the land burst forth below them, a rugged pictorial straight out of National Geographic, with high plateaus jutting out of the lush greenery like a setting from Jurassic Park. While the tourists and locals took in the splendor, Johann looked more clinically. He didn't care about the beauty, he cared about a drop zone, a location where he could insert the team that would be close enough to the capital city of Maseru, for his operation yet far enough away to not be noticed. A DZ that didn't require a hard slog to a rendezvous with transport, because he'd need the men fresh. Once they hit the ground, they'd be in motion for 48 hours straight, and every bit of energy he could conserve on the front end would pay dividends on the back. He knew from experience. Johann had perpetrated violence in many, many different countries inside Africa. But this would be the first time he did so in his own homeland. Well, not really his homeland, but close enough. He had been born and raised in South Africa, a country that had fought between Dutch and British parentage for a century in various civil wars, until the country abandoned both, declaring outright independence. Then, as if it couldn't stand to be without an enemy, the country began to fight itself, with the colonial masters now pitted against the native population. What had once been seen as a side note in the colonial era, as the Dutch Boers took on the British military, became the main event. The politics of apartheid eventually consumed the state. Johann came of age at the end of the White Rule era and the beginning of One Man, One Vote. A newly minted member of the famed South African reconnaissance commandos, the Rekkies, he served in 5 Rekke on the small teams, doing external work in the border wars, a vicious, guttural fight that nobody else on the planet even knew existed. He learned there were no winners, only survivors. After risking his life alongside black tribal members, men who were now his brothers, he came home from a final tour only to find his unit disbanded. There was a new South Africa, and it was all about majority rule and dismantling anything that smacked of the elite apartheid state. He'd left at that point, anxious about the fire consuming the country he called home. He had a unique skill and a talent for using it that had been forged in combat. He'd plied that skill all over the continent, working with whomever would hire him. But as he did, his view of the world began to harden. He'd once been a member of an organization that held honor above all. Now, honor was secondary to money. He'd signed on with Executive Outcomes, Sandline International, and a few other outfits, fighting from Angola to Sierra Leone, on behalf of everyone from De Beers Diamonds to national governments. And he'd seen that his talent could do both good and bad. Initially, the work had been pure, with a chain of command that understood the continent, and a body of men who grasped war at the visceral level. But the taint of the mercenary hung large over them, eventually forcing the various companies out of business, even as the African countries that had hired them praised their contributions. After that, things had not been so clean, with him working solely for monetary gain with little in the way of moral restraint. He didn't mind a coup here and there. Hell, the entire continent was a mess of intrigue. But he began to have misgivings. When he looked in the mirror, he preferred to see someone who righted the wrongs of the world with the barrel of a gun, not someone who killed for money. In his heart, he knew that was nothing more than a myth. He'd seen enough evil to know he wasn't pure. Once, long ago, he'd helped a warlord achieve success, and then he'd watched the man order the massacre of an entire village, solely because he believed, against all evidence, that the village had been against him. Johann had done nothing. He'd let the slaughter happen, and in so doing had become complicit in the deaths. To this day, he would lie awake at night hearing the screams, knowing he could have stopped it. To be sure, it wasn't his fault, he wasn't in charge. But he did have a rifle in his hand, and had failed to use it to prevent the massacre. In time, he'd become somewhat of an anomaly in the cloistered world of mercenaries on the continent. Most of the hires would do whatever was asked, cloaking their activities inside the parameters of the job. He was different. Among the major players in Africa, he was known as the Lily Boy, a purist who didn't understand the dirt required under the nails to accomplish the mission. Johann didn't care. As he had recently shown in his interrogation of the Jew, a little dirt never bothered him if it was necessary. It was the mission alone that mattered to him. It didn't have to be noble, but it couldn't be outright evil. Their aircraft came into final approach, and off in the distance he saw a large escarpment with a single dirt road snaking to the top. The terrain was flat and isolated, without any structures that he could see. It was his drop zone. Johann mentally recorded the flight path, judging where the radar arrays would be aimed to track the approaches of civilian aircraft, wanting to avoid them when they came in on an aircraft that most certainly wasn't going to land. He didn't worry about military systems. He knew Lesotho had no air defense systems to speak of. Such a thing would be absurd, as their borders were protected by South Africa. Like the Italian microstates of the Holy See and the Republic of San Marino, Lesotho was an island in the middle of another country completely surrounded. While Lesotho claimed sovereignty, it knew its hold on power was at the behest of the surrounding state, in this case, South Africa. Lesotho was a mountainous land, its entire history a fight for survival, with the country founded by a tribe seeking refuge from the more martial Zulu clans. Climbing high into the mountains, the Basotho tribe had built a kingdom in rugged terrain that was just too hard to attack. The first king, Moshoeshoe I, had proven adept at the skills of both fighting and diplomacy, and had guaranteed the kingdom's survival by engendering the protection of the British. When South Africa had declared independence from the United Kingdom, so had Lesotho, and it had lived ever since as a sovereign state, surrounded completely by the country of South Africa in a strangely symbiotic relationship. Its primary export was water, drawn from the dams in the highlands, and its primary customer was South Africa, making the country of Lesotho a strategic resource that irrevocably altered its ability to forge its own destiny. No matter what happened in the small kingdom, South Africa was inexorably tied to the outcome. The last bit of unrest in Lesotho had caused a proactive response from the surrounding state. Ostensibly to stop the bloodshed, South Africa had deployed troops in a peacekeeping role, and it would have been seen as a true gesture of goodwill, except that the troops deployed to the dams that control the water into South Africa, letting the blood flow as long as the water did. The implication from that deployment was clear. Lesotho could pretend to be sovereign, but only so long as it was peaceful. Besides water, Lesotho had one other blessing, or curse, depending on whom you asked. The mountains produced some of the largest gem-quality diamonds on earth. The kimberlite mines of Lesotho did little to help the poverty of the average Basotho tribe member, but they were why Johann's skills had been brought in. Lesotho had had a number of coups in its history, some bloodier than others, but none that relied on the help of an outside element. Johann's job would be to topple the government as rapidly as possible, using a martial skill that the troops in Lesotho could only dream of. His boss's job would be to placate the South African High Command. Johann wasn't privy to the details, that wasn't his job, but he believed Colonel Armstrong was using his contacts in South Africa to keep them at bay. He didn't know for sure, and in fact didn't want to know, but he understood that as long as the coup was relatively bloodless and swift, South Africa would stay away. If it turned into a street fight, South Africa was coming in just as they had before, and Colonel Armstrong's plan would fail. The small aircraft hit the tarmac and rolled up to the lone gate of the Meshoy Shui I International Airport. A little bit of a misnomer because the only flights that came in were from Johannesburg. Looking more like an airfield at an island resort than the sole international airport for an entire country, the limited infrastructure made Johann smile. It was a good sign. 25. Johann turned on his phone as he waited for the passengers to deplane, seeing a string of text messages appear, all demanding he call. He wondered what had happened in Tel Aviv, but he certainly couldn't talk on the aircraft. Eventually, he walked down the air stairs and across the chipped tarmac. He entered the airport, a one-story brick building with only two rooms, one for departures and one for arrivals, and waited on his luggage. Through the window, he watched a single man open the small cargo hold of the aircraft and began transferring the bags by hand, without the benefit of a conveyor belt. He knew it would be a while. He retreated to the corner of the room and dialed his phone, the text messages beckoning him, becoming more than he could ignore. In short order, he learned the disaster of the attempt to eliminate the partner of the man they'd captured. And it was total. Not only had three of his men been killed, but the woman was still on the loose. Who in the fuck was she? There was no way she could have escaped his team without help. No way. So what now? Maybe they'd misread the man they'd caught. Maybe he was Mossad, but that made no sense. Their contact in the diamond exchange, who would know, said he wasn't. Either way, it was a disaster. And all the more reason to keep the man they'd caught alive. They'd need to hand him over after the coup to defuse any response. The last thing Johann needed was another private military organization hunting his ass down because he'd killed one of their own, especially one from Israel. He said, "What's your assessment?" "Johann, she killed three of my men. Three trained men. That's not luck. That's skill. Something else is in play here." "Any indications of Mossad efforts? Any at all?" "No. The man inside the diamond exchange used to be an intelligence, and he assures us that the effort earlier in Joburg was just a stab in the dark. According to him, nobody in Israel cares." "Then why are there three men dead?" He heard nothing for a moment, then, "You want my honest answer?" "Yes. The woman we went after wasn't his control. I don't know what she is, but she wasn't some meek desk worker waiting on his contact report. She's a fucking killer, and she had help. One of my guys was incapacitated by a black man." "African?" "No. The man he took out said he spoke English with an American accent." "What the fuck? American? So should we continue? Is this team a threat?" "Honestly, I don't even know if it was a team. We tracked her to a hotel and she was alone. I don't know where that guy came from or where he went after. He did nothing to help her when she was under attack." Johann took that in and thought for a moment. He came up with nothing to ask. He said, "Give me your gut instinct on this. The mission takes priority. We gave her a scare, and she's on the run. We lost track of both her and the black man, but they have no idea what's going on. She might try to decipher our plan, but it won't be in Lesotho. If anything, she'll show up in Joburg hunting her partner's last location, which is our terrain, and we can kill her at our leisure." Johann's voice grew hard. "A scare, Andy. It cost the lives of three men. Three men I needed. I'm not so sure you are not to blame." Johann heard nothing for a moment, then pure venom. "You fuck. I don't know why you've been brought on board, but the dead are my men, my men. Don't question me on my operations. The police here are going batshit. We don't have the cover to continue hunting her here, even if we wanted to. We need to bail. Johann backed off. The men on the team were all special forces, most from South Africa. But Johann had been long gone from that world, having spent close to a decade working for the United States in Jordan, so much so that he no longer knew who was worthy or not on the continent. The team was much younger than him, and outside of his orbit of personal connections. All he had was Colonel Armstrong, a man he knew by reputation, and someone who had lived what he had. Armstrong had built the team, and if he said they were good, then they were. Johann said, "Okay, okay. I'm in Lesotho now. I need you to get to Cape Town anyway. Check out the shipment. I've identified the drop zone, but I need you to check the goods to make sure. Colonel Armstrong is there now, and he has the contact information." "I can do that." "Then go. Get to Cape Town. Get out of the heat of Tel Aviv. Make sure that American arms dealer hasn't screwed us." He heard, "Will do," then hung up. Johann put his phone away, realizing he'd become engrossed in the conversation and worried that someone had overheard. He surreptitiously glanced around, but nobody was near him. He saw a porter manhandle a cart full of luggage inside and recognized his bag in the middle. He waited on the man to finish unloading, found his luggage, and prepared to exit, only to be surprised that he had to place the bag on an X-ray machine for customs. That was stricter than the routine of any country he'd entered in the last 2 years. He did so with some trepidation, because he had something to hide. The customs officer behind the screen pinged on an item, and Johann knew what it was. The beacon he was to emplace on the drop zone. As the official opened his luggage, Johann began developing a story on the fly to explain the device. The official pulled out a square container a little fatter than a box of tissues, asking, "What is this?" Johann inwardly sighed in relief. He'd also brought with him a quadcopter unmanned aerial vehicle for the reconnaissance he was about to conduct, something that was much easier to explain. "A drone, you know, a flying camera. I take pictures with it. I'm a photographer. And I want to get some landscape shots of your waterfalls." "Show me." Johann pulled open the Velcro top and withdrew a DJI Mavic Pro. The four lift propellers collapsed into the body. He unfolded them, then pretended to have it zoom left and right, saying, "I fly it, and it takes pictures." The customs official smiled and said, "Put away. Pull away." In short order, Johann was on his way. But that one encounter told him all he needed to know about trying to bring in a team overtly. They'd considered it because they were sure that they could bring a howitzer into the country without any question, but it turned out, as it had on every other mission he'd done, that his choice to conduct a recon early had been prudent. He had 2 days to figure out how to take down an entire country, and he was sure he could. He'd done it before, and in lands far more complicated than Lesotho. What he was unsure about was the woman in Israel. Admittedly, she was a small pinprick, a nothing in the greater plan they had in play. But she had proven lethal, and that was worrying.
26. I heard a knock on the door and knew it wasn't the maids. I looked at Jennifer and said, "Here we go, get ready for the shit show." She said,
"You can talk her off the ledge."
I turned to the door and said, "I don't think so. The ledge has become about an inch wide." I opened the door, seeing Shoshana outside it, her face determined. I said, "You're a little early for lunch." She brushed past me, saying,
"I don't want lunch. What did your vaunted task force say?"
I let her storm into our decidedly small room without complaint. I knew she was on the verge of going berserk because of some stupid theory about Aaron, and she was still a little embarrassed about the whole honeymoon lie. I escaped to our tiny bathroom, letting Jennifer handle her for a minute. We'd spent about 30 seconds inside the Turkish bazaar before bundling up Shoshana and fleeing Acker. She'd wanted to question the guy I'd knocked to the ground, but I already knew he would be worthless for information, and that she probably wanted to inflict pain more than gather intel. I had no idea how many men were on the team we'd interdicted, and had no intention of finding out. After an all-too-brief reunion, where she'd immediately turned into a slaughter monster wanting to kill the guy, we hit the road, me practically dragging her to our car. Once on the highway, with Shoshana muttering expletives, I'd asked her where to go. She began to take me to task for making her leave, and I told her to back off, a little miffed at the lack of gratitude. Seeing the fireworks building, Jennifer had interjected, and of course, that had been enough. It aggravated the shit out of me, but those two had some secret connection, and it was enough to calm the little demon down. I'd asked her where we should go to lie low, and Shoshana had pulled a hotel out of thin air, giving me directions, but first demanded we go back to her hotel room. That was ridiculous, and we started to build up into a fight again. Once again, like a mother separating two irate siblings, Jennifer stepped in, first asking Shoshana why it was necessary, to which she said she needed her clothes, her phone, and any other identifiable things in the room. In pure Shoshana fashion, she checked in under an alias and wanted to sterilize the site to protect herself. Which was a point, I guess. Jennifer then asked me why not, to which I basically exploded that it was idiotic to return to a room full of dead bodies from an assassination team that was still chasing us. The thought spoke for itself, except Shoshana said now was the best time to return, before the bodies were found and after the team was left in disarray, which was another good point. I reluctantly agreed to at least conduct a recce to see if it was possible, stating that if there was any chance of compromise, we were out of there. Of course, we'd slipped in and out without issue, and Shoshana had gloated with a told-you-so look. I'd asked her where we were supposed to go now, and she gave me directions to the hotel. It was one near Ben-Gurion Airport, and I'd asked why there. She told me the reasons, and they made sense. Called the Sadat, or Fields in Hebrew, it was a small boutique establishment situated in a medical complex. It was the closest hotel to Ben-Gurion, just 20 minutes to the terminal, and, more important, sat behind a guarded gate. Only patients and hotel residents were allowed to pass, and with the security posture of Israel, it was a layer of protection we could use. The rooms were microscopic, but the location was outside anything that my team or Shoshana had touched. It would do. We'd conducted a detailed hot wash of what had occurred, with Shoshana pinging back and forth between emotions, like she was short-circuiting. Eventually, she'd calmed down enough to tell us about Aaron and the busted honeymoon. Only now, she was convinced that the entire event was some sort of indicator that Aaron was in trouble. She'd called him, but the phone rang out to voicemail, just like it had when I'd tried earlier, and I could see the tension rising in her. She would remain on the leash only so long. She'd wanted to fly straight to Johannesburg and rip that town apart looking for Aaron, but I'd convinced her to let me leverage the task force. I'd sent everything I had, a complete situation report, license plate numbers, descriptions of the men, the phone numbers we had, and the strange nexus between my target, the hit team, and the diamond exchange. Kurt had told me to give him 8 to 10 hours. Now that time was up, and Shoshana wanted answers. Through the bathroom door, I heard Jennifer say,
"Kurt hasn't called back yet. Give it time."
Shoshana went to classic Shoshana.
"Fuck that. We're sitting here wasting time. We know those operators were from South Africa, and Aaron's last known location was Johannesburg. That little sex pot from the diamond exchange probably set him up."
I heard the words from inside the bathroom and immediately perked up. Earlier, I'd asked Shoshana what Aaron was doing, and she, of course, refused to tell me anything beyond the fact that he was operational. It wasn't upsetting,
because beyond telling her we'd crossed paths with the guys hunting her, I'd also refused to say anything about what I was doing. We'd both reverted to our operational security, and my mission, while obviously tied in with her somehow, had been outside the scope of what she needed to know. But that comment